Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. NBC called Greg Kinn Rock's True Renaissance Man. Apple iTunes Music called the Greg Kinn Band a rock band of genuine consequence. As a pioneer with legendary Berserkly Records, Greg Kinn helped write the book on revolutionary West Coast rock and roll. He's toured the world, had hit records, and has won several awards for his hit songs Jeopardy, Breakup Song, and Lucky. After recently obtaining the rights to all his old recordings, Greg Kinn remastered and re-released his entire catalog. In support of these releases and his latest 2018 album, Rekindled, the iconic San Francisco Bay Area rocker, radio personality, and author has been going out with the Greg Kinn Band all across the country. When the Greg Kinn Band wasn't rocking, Greg was on the road as part of Rick Springfield's Best in Show 2018 tour. The Greg Kinn Band and the Best in Show tour picked up 2019 dates, so check Greg's calendar for an upcoming show near you. The Greg Kinn Band consists of Greg Kinn on lead vocals and guitar, Greg's son, Roy Kinn, on lead guitar vocals, Robert Berry, who's been on this show, on bass and vocals, and David Lauser on drums. Fans who see the band will really appreciate the new 90-minute set consisting of all Greg Kinn original material, like the big hits, Jeopardy, and breakup songs, fan favorites such as Happy Man and Can't Stop Hurt Myself, as well as new material from his latest Rekindled album. Greg is also a renowned author of 4 novels and 1 book of short stories. Please welcome American rock musician, songwriter, radio personality, and novelist, Greg Kinn, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Ray, how's it going, man?
We're doing good, man. I'm here in sunny Florida. I moved down here about 16 years ago, but, of course, we have the connection, the Baltimore connection.
Yeah, the Baltimore connection is a thick thing, and it takes a lifetime to really break it. In fact, it never really broke. You can take the boy out of Baltimore, but you can't take the Baltimore out of the boy.
That's a God's honest truth.
Yeah, but you know, I think growing up in Baltimore back in, you know, I'm probably a little older than you, but I remember, you know, the 60s.
Right.
And the 70s, and it was kind of like happy days, you know, it was like, you know, the Fonz and people like that. It was very innocent. For instance, we used to hitchhike. When I was in high school, we thought nothing of hitchhiking up to, say, the Maryland State Fair.
Right.
You know, we hitchhiked right up Greenmount Avenue. Because nothing bad ever happened. You know, you usually were picked up by another guy who was like, hey, yeah, I'll give you guys this. You know, and I always thought, you know, we were kind of blessed because those days are gone for good.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, we always left our doors open, too. We never locked the doors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's the, you know, and my mother, bless her soul, you know, she never locked the door. Never.
You know the song, the song Pleasant Valley Sunday, you know, the Carole King song that the monkeys sing, that reminds me of the neighborhood. You know, the barbecue.
The guy with the TV in every room, right, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I remember, my entire life really started. Greg Kinn really was born the night that I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I must have been 12 years old.
Yep.
And I remember, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, I had already been into folk music,
mm-hmm,
and my cousins, you know, turned me on to the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I got a guitar and I learned, you know, the three chords of life.
Yep.
And, I just started, and then the shock was that the Beatles came out. It was like, oh my God, the same three chords that I was using for, you know, Blowing in the Wind is also the same three chords of half the Beatles song. Yeah. So it was a revelation. And, really, WCAO, do you remember that, the Top 40 station?
Oh yeah, definitely.
They had it, and I still have the plaque, man. Mm-hmm. I still have it. They had a talent contest, I think it was 1967 or 68.
Right.
And it was, you know, the Baltimore's talent. So, mm-hmm, unbeknownst to me, my mom sent in a tape. You know, I had a little reel-to-reel tape recorder. Sure. I used to go in the bathroom, the shower stall, and cut, you know, tracks in there because it sounded kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, unbeknownst to me, my mother sent it into the radio station, WCAO,
mm-hmm,
and lo and behold, I won. It must have been a terrible year for talent. But I won! You know, and I won three things that changed my life. Well, one of them was an electric guitar. It, yep, was a Vox Teardrop. I still got it.
Wow.
The other thing was an electric typewriter. Of course, this is way before computers.
Sure.
But, you know, I started womping on that thing right off the bat. It was such a kick writing stories and so forth. And a stack of records, which I wound up, you know, playing on the radio when I, you know, back when I was, well, I was doing the morning show on K-Fox Radio,
mm-hmm,
in San Francisco.
Yep.
For 17 years.
Yep.
And it was during that 17 years, I think a lot of people just forgot about me, you know, because we didn't tour. I didn't have to. I was making money. Sure. You know, I didn't really, I'd kind of beaten my head against the wall with the touring back in the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, it was nice to not do anything. But then after, I parted ways with K-Fox, that was about 3 years ago.
Right.
It was time to go back out on the road again, and and it was a lot of fun. I found out that a lot of the things I thought were tedious back in the 80s, mm-hmm, when I was on the road, it's like summer camp for rock stars.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
That's right. You know,
I love playing the gigs. I, yeah, love the audience. I love meeting people. It's a wonderful thing.
You need to get some of a few gigs on the ships. You know, have you done one of those yet?
Yeah, we flirted with that a couple of times.
Yeah,
I did it once, and I realized a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I got seasick, so that wasn't good. Number two is all you do is eat. You know, there's not much else to do but eat.
Yeah.
Eat the whole time.
Right.
And the other one is there's no place to go, you know, when you're got a ship full of fans,
mm-hmm,
and they all want to talk to you.
That's true.
Really. And then, you know, what can you do? Just like, hide in your stateroom, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you get to meet all the other guys.
Yeah, we're going
to
be doing a thing down in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
I believe it's in September, and we're going there, it's part of a rock festival, and I'll be playing, but you know, all that problems with the Dominican, you know,
yeah,
how many Americans have died.
That's right.
In the past 2 years. So, you know, of course, everybody around here is going, are you sure you want He's indestructible.
That's true.
He cannot be killed with conventional weapons. And I'm going to say, right next to Sammy, the whole time, nothing bad is going to happen to Sammy Hagar, and nothing bad is going to happen to me, because I'll be standing right next to him. But that's the way I'm going to approach this.
Well, I got some of the dates right here. November 6th, let's see, it's Punta Cana. Is that how you pronounce it?
Punta
Cana, Dominican Republic, and Lita Ford's going to be there.
Yep.
Debbie Gibson, John Waite, Patti Smyth, Glass Tiger. Wow, that's a pretty good game.
A lot of friends, old friends of mine are on the bill. You know, like I remember playing with Patti Smyth way back in the 80s when they were having their big hit. Yeah, and of course, it's always great to be, I love it when I play with my contemporaries. So I think this is going to be a kind of a cool gig, and it's going to be a gathering of the tribe, so to speak.
You got some other gigs coming up, too, with Rick Springfield and Eddie Money as well in September.
Yeah. I've been loving these Springfield shows.
Right.
First of all the pressure is on him. Because I'm just the opener. I just go out there and play whatever I want.
Right.
And it's really loose and a lot of fun. Of course, we do all the hits. And, you know, we do a standard Greg Ginn show. But I always throw in at least one or two new songs.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously we got to do the hits. But,
right.
Doing these Rick Springfield shows, I remember touring all over North America with Rick Springfield in the 80s, back in, I think, 83.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we played all over the place, and I loved it because his audience is, 99% female. I mean, we're talking chicks. You look out in the audience, and there's no guys. It's all chicks.
What's wrong with that?
It's a wonderful audience. What can I say? They love it. They appreciate it.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. So I've been actually all of these Springfield things have turned out to be a blessing in disguise. I've known Rick, going back to the 80s, and he's just such a nice guy.
Right.
And the guys in the crew and the band, and they treat you with respect, and it's wonderful. So I liked, I think there's a couple more before the year's over.
Right.
But, I'm looking forward to probably doing more of these dates tomorrow, next year.
Greg, is Robert Berry on the show with you? Or is he? Just on
certain gigs,
okay.
I use Rick's Springfield's band.
Okay.
And when I'm playing with Tommy Two Tone, also uses Rick's band.
Okay.
But I've got them, we've rehearsed them, and they're really good.
Mm-hmm.
They're top of the line musicians.
Right.
So, but usually when I go out there and I'm the headliner, or we're playing a more of an expanded role, I bring my band, because, my band is the best.
Yeah.
Best
oh,
in
yeah.
town, man.
Sure.
My son Rye is unbelievable. He's right up there with Satriani. In fact, he's a former student of Joe Satriani.
Oh, really? Huh.
And, the guy grew up, I watched him, he grew up backstage.
Yeah.
He saw all the great guitar players come marching through the Greg Ginn band,
mm-hmm.
starting with Dave Carpenter, Greg Douglas, Jimmy Lyon,
mm-hmm.
Joe Satriani. There was a bunch of good, really good guitar players, and he saw them all. So we usually, for instance, if we're doing the breakup song,
mm-hmm.
and there's an extended solo at the end, he throws in a little bit of this and a little bit of that, so you get an echo of the original with Dave Carpenter, and then you get echoes of Joe Satriani. I've seen these two guys jam. We've played a couple of gigs together.
Right.
And Joe came out and joined Rye, and they were he was, I think he was on two albums and did a couple of tours together. But, you know, the guy was spectacular. And I used to love just watching him.
Right.
You know what I mean? I get caught up in watching what he was doing. And, of course, you know, Joe, even those days, had a real fan base of guitar aficionados.
Mm-hmm.
And they would follow him all over the place.
You know, the Suns are taking over, man. They're the new generation. You know, we have Dickie Betts here in Sarasota. And, of course, you know, his son has kind of taken over and playing like in a new version of the Allman Brothers, and he's incredible as well. Dwayne Betts.
Hey, here's a kick. You ready for this?
Okay.
I have grandsons now.
Yep.
Okay, right. I'm a grandpa.
So am I.
And my grandsons are 10 and 7, respectively.
Right.
10 and 7 years old.
Okay.
So, and I've already got them started on guitar.
All right.
And I got them started on the keyboards, and they're already unbelievable. So I figure in about 10 years, you know, when these kids are like 15 to 17,
yep.
There'll be three generations of Kins
awesome.
In the Greg Kin Band. Isn't that a trip?
Yeah, family business, man.
I love it. You know, that's one of the reasons I love Robert Barry so much.
Yeah.
He's like a brother. I've known him forever.
He's a good guy.
And when Steve Wright died, that was a shocker to everybody.
Yeah.
But he just stepped right in there, and I really enjoyed working. Not only, you know, I go over there once a week and hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, the pure songwriting days, right?
Yeah.
Like, I go over, like, around 11 in the morning, and I stay until, like, 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
Right.
And we just pick around ideas.
Sure.
And we're right there in the studio, so if we get something that we like, we can lay it down right there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everything is digital now. My whole universe was analog,
right.
And then suddenly digital.
Yep.
I remember, for instance, I think the first Greg Kin album got berserkly distributed by Playboy Records. I remember this way back in, God, it was 76.
Wow.
Okay. Unbelievable that we recorded the whole thing on a 4-track machine. 4 tracks was standard at that time.
That's right.
And remember, like, Sergeant Bevan was done on a 4-track.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't know any better. We just went, you know, with a 4-track, you had to be very economical
sure.
in how you delineated the tracks.
Yeah.
So you had to have a really well-rehearsed band to do what they were doing because you didn't have a lot of, you know, second takes and stuff. And then between the first and second album, Greg Kin Again was the second album. That was the one with 4U on it.
Right.
That was, it's just that, you know, it was like maybe fall to spring, but in that time they had come out with a 16-track Ampex machine.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 2-inch tape, remember the big thick 2-inch
sure.
tape?
Sure.
Ampex machines, mm-hmm. and they were 16 tracks, and I remember telling Glenn Kolodkin, you know, who was engineering the thing, I said, Glenn, we're never going to use 16 tracks. We're a 4-track band, man.
Yeah, yeah.
We've always done it. We think in 4-track.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, you'll find a way. So nowadays, 16 tracks, they probably use just on the drums alone.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And it's, you know, it's a digital world. And
yeah.
I'm not complaining. In fact, I like it because when we're kicking around song ideas, when I go over to, I'm going to be going over tomorrow to Robert's
mm-hmm.
to hang out for the day. We're going to kick around some song ideas. But if we come up with something, all he has to do is press a button.
Yep.
There's no tape involved.
Yeah.
It's all Pro Tools.
Yep.
It's all on computer now, man.
It's amazing.
And everything is digital. And I remember, because my entire career was spent in analog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we made vinyl for, you know, our entire career.
Right.
Vinyl for God's sake. Yeah. And that's like, you know, that's like buggy whips in today's world.
Greg, I want to tell you, man, I know it's been about 21 years since you cut a new album, and nothing has changed. I gave your album 5 stars, Rekindle. It is a great album. I really, really enjoyed it, and I love every track.
Thank you.
Love every track.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I had a lot of fun making the album.
Well, it's you. I mean,
We did that kind of on the fly, you know.
That's like, the best way.
I go in and we write a song.
Yeah.
The band would come in, they rehearse it, we cut it right there on the spot.
Yep.
We kept the overdubs down to a minimum.
Good album.
And there's so many, I can tell it's a good one because I still have a lot of, I love the songs.
Yep, me too.
You know, and some of my favorite new songs are on there, like Big Pink Flamingos and the Life I Got and Cassandra.
Yep, Cassandra's cool.
It was really fun making that album. In fact, we're about 4 cuts into the next one.
Oh, awesome.
Just kicking around song ideas. So, yep. You know, it's very organic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you write the song, you record the song. You know, it's just, you're right there. And I'm addicted to that, man. I'm the creative process. Mm-hmm. My whole life revolves around the creative process. You know, I'm always doing something creative. I'm either writing a novel or doing something on the radio or writing a song or recording a song or, you know, and when I get guys that are in tune with me, like Robert and Rye,
mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it really, you get so much done and it's so much. It's pleasing. It's pleasing to the ear. I like the songs. We do a lot of these songs live in the current show, and people love them. You know, they sing along and they don't even know them.
Well, they're great live songs. I mean, you know, The Life I Got to me is Vintage Kin. Very cool track. It's a rocker. Like you said, Big Pink Flamingos, kind of a rockability track. Very, very cool. Very, very cool. Cassandra, I loved it. It was kind of a rocker punker type of tune. Tell me something good.
Yeah, it sounds like something maybe the Ramones would do.
Right, exactly. Tell me something good, cool intro. You know, tell me something good. World Gone Mad. I mean, self-explanatory.
that is self-explanatory.
And, you know, I wrote the book reminded me of Alice Cooper. I think Alice Cooper could do that tune.
Hey, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I said this to Alice.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm writing songs, I visualize, okay, this is going to be like a Ramones song.
Right.
Or this is going to be like a Tom Petty song.
Right.
So when you're starting, you can see, you know, there's different ways of songwriting, you know. Some guys write the lyrics first, some guys come up with a melody, some guys do it both spontaneously, some guys, like, you know, Lennon McCartney, for instance, they leaned on each other for the middle eight.
Right.
But whatever the bridge was, it was the other guy, and it was just, it was a perfect formula for writing songs. And, you know, over the years, I've tried everything, all the big hits, like Jeopardy and the breakup song, were all written in like 15 minutes.
Well, that's why they're so good.
The songs that I sweated over didn't even make the album.
That's why they're so good. You know, the Beatles did the same thing. Most of their big hits were very quick, you know, written fast, you know?
You know, I can't tell you how much the Beatles meant to me growing up. And, of course, this was at a time when the music was really important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was how we all communicated with each other.
Right.
And, you know, and it used to really mean something. When I was like 18, and there was a new Rolling Stones album, let's say, when Out of Our Heads came out, for instance, I remember that. I went down to the mom and pop record store down the street from my mom's house.
Right.
And I bought it the first day it was out.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited. I was pumped up, and everybody I knew was like that.
Yep.
It's not like that anymore. I don't know if people go out and, you know, I think they would line up, you know, more for a new ISO than they would for like a
probably.
New Beatles album.
Probably. Hey, we were listening to AM transistor radios.
Oh, yeah. I Baltimore had some of the great soul stations.
Yeah, they did.
And I remember when I was growing up, WSID and WWIN with Fat Daddy.
Yep.
Remember Fat Daddy?
Sure, I do.
Yeah, I mean, he used to do, you know, you'll scream and holler as you spend your dollar.
Yeah.
You know, he just used to rap and he was great. And then there was another guy, Commander Hot Rod.
Mm-hmm. I remember him.
I remember all this stuff. And it was like, you know, when I was in junior high and high school, the Beatles hit and all this stuff exploded. And, you know, I couldn't get enough of music.
Yeah.
I used to listen to gospel music. I had no idea what I was listening to. It just sounded cool, right? It was on WWIN.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later that it was the Reverend Julius Cheeks. Julius Cheeks is recognized as the greatest singer of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes James Brown look like Al Martino, man. He's got the roughest voice you've ever... You know, kind of like a Wilson Pickett.
Right.
Really, just really down.
I love Wilson Pickett. He was the best.
And you got to check out Julius Cheeks.
Okay, I'll look it up.
Julius Cheeks, you know what? I'll tell you, here's how I know about Julius Cheeks. I was seeing James Brown. James Brown played at the Stone on Broadway in San Francisco.
Right.
And I used to play at the Stone and the Keystones, the Keystone Berkeley and the Keystone Palo Alto all the time. And I was really good friends with everybody. So I got, you know, I could walk in and go backstage and meet James Brown, right?
Cool.
I go back and I meet, and I'm with Joel Selvin of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Right.
And he's writing it up, you know, he's writing the show up. And he asked James Brown, who the greatest, in his estimation, who's the greatest singer of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Without blinking, he just said, "Oh, Reverend Julius Cheeks."
Really?
And the next day, I went out to Village Music in Mule Valley.
Right.
Had a guy named John Goddard there.
Right.
And I bought the whole, you know, they had a little bin there. It was like five or six Julius Cheeks albums. I bought them all. Bought them all and started listening to it. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
The guy is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And by the way, I weighed. These guys, I would put people in my novels based on these guys. And I don't know if you've ever read Rubber Soul and the sequel to that, Painted Black, because Julius Cheeks is in there and Fat Daddy is in there.
Really?
And, I mean, Commander Hot Rod, all these old characters. You know, they're all gone now, so I can basically make up dialogue, and it's stuff that they would have said anyway. I haven't mentioned anything about the novels, but, you know, my last two novels have been Beatles novels, and I started off when I was on the radio doing the morning show on K-Fox. Now, K-Fox is a very big station,
right?
A classic rock station in San Francisco. You can imagine the big market's booming, right?
Yeah.
So, McCartney comes to town, he doesn't do one interview except for K-Fox, because, you know, of course, we were doing, supporting the show. And he knew who Greg Ginn was, so he was all there. I got to talk to Ringo twice and Paul McCartney twice, and I asked him the same question. question. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to know, where did the Beatles get their music?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, they didn't, there were no import shops. There were no, I mean, how did they get Twist and Shout from the Isley Brothers?
Yeah.
How did they find Please Mr. Postman by the Marvelettes?
Yeah,
because
they only had the BBC, I believe. They didn't have any regular stations.
They didn't play that kind of stuff.
Right.
They didn't really play rock and roll,
right,
especially American imports.
Exactly.
So they both gave me the same chart, and Paul gave me a really great in-depth thing. He said, I went to high school with a guy. In Liverpool, and we grew up together. He joined the Merchant Marines.
Oh,
and he goes back and forth between Liverpool and New York every week.
There you go.
And he brings back all these 45s, like all the latest Ray Charles, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, all the R&B guys that you couldn't hear or even find.
Right.
In England, boom, it was going nuts in New York.
Yep.
So, and they bring back stacks of records, and these records would find their way, you know, to secondhand stores.
Yep.
And, you know, collectors, mm-hmm, and so forth. And it gave me the idea for a guy who's got a secondhand store. His name is Dustin Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And Dustin Bob, his name is Bob Dingle. But they call him Dustbin Bob because he's like the dustbin guy. He's always looking in the trash for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes really good friends with the Beatles because they need his records.
Mm-hmm.
So they go over there once a week, and they've grown up together. And he became best friends with the Beatles. And all through the years, he'd show up at key junkets, and it culminates with he saves the Beatles' lives from an assassination attempt,
really,
by the Marcos regime in the Philippines,
right,
in 1967, I think.
Yeah, because they blew off Marcos, right? Or
they blew him off, and the next thing, it was really hostile.
Yeah,
and they pulled up. And I remember, because I talked to Ringo about,
mm-hmm,
that.
Right.
And this is part of being on the radio, so I could work all my questions in as part of the interview.
Sure.
You know, I was getting all this information from my novels. Anyway, you know, it was like he thought that they were going to get shocked. And
I remember that.
Brian Epstein told them, they got, you know, in those days there was a tarmac, they didn't have jetways.
Right.
They had to run across the tarmac. And Epstein tells the guys, look, boys, I want you to run, not walk, run,
mm-hmm,
to the plane and run up the stairs and get in the plane as soon as possible. He thought they were assassins, and they could have been.
Yep.
On the roofs in the Manila airport, which is where they get everybody, by the way,
right,
at the airport.
Right.
So, and they really feared assassination. And, but as, you know, in my novel, yes, Dustin Bob, mm-hmm, saves the day. But, yeah, you gotta read all that stuff.
I will.
It's available on the gregkin.com website.
Yep.
Along with all of my other stuff. You know, I mentioned that, I've reissued all the stuff, and, mm-hmm, I'll tell you, it was great to be able to buy this stuff back.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't believe, you know, these record companies come and go, and they go out of business, and like, somehow, Berserkly had been, sold to Sanctuary,
right,
in England, and then Sanctuary had been sold to, it's been three or four. I think Sony now has everything.
Yeah.
But as the years went by, whenever things went up for sale, I bought them. And now I own my entire catalog, original artwork, original master recordings,
so
everything. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it is so important. Yeah, so many people lost their original tapes and everything, like,
yep,
fire,
death. All of my friends, guys,
yep,
like Eddie Money,
yep,
and Joan Jett, people like that, everybody lost those early
I know. I'm friends with Frank Marino, you know, from Mahogany Rush.
And Mahogany.
Same thing happened to him. Somebody recorded over his tapes.
Oh, my God. That's the biggest insult there is.
I know. It's pretty sad. I want to mention to everybody about your books, because they are incredible. You've got Rubber Soul, Painted Black. You've got, is it Horror Show?
Horror Show, which was nominated for the Bram Stoker Award.
Oh, wow.
Best first novel.
That's awesome.
I was really pleased with that.
Yep.
And then there were four novels which I had signed a deal with Tor Books, G-O-R.
Right.
Books, and they were in the flag. I didn't talk about New York publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Their headquarters was in the Flatiron Building.
Right.
And I had to go to New York to sign the contracts and stuff.
Yep.
And you know, I mean, in the Flatiron Building. You know, have you ever seen that? It's like, it's this kind of triangular building. You see it in all of, it's been there since like the 1920s.
Right, right.
And every writer who ever lived, from Hemingway to Greg Kinn, has walked those halls.
Yeah.
And all of the book companies are in this one building, the Flatiron Building. Mm-hmm. And so I did Horror Show. That was my first published novel in 96, I believe.
Okay.
And then that got nominated, and then Shade of Pale, which is my Banshee. That was a straight up horror thing. And then, Mojo Hand.
Right.
Which was the sequel to Horror Show. And then Big Rock Beat, which was the sequel to Mojo Hand.
Right.
So they were all linked up together.
Huh.
You know, I'll tell you, that's the fun of writing books. You
yep.
create this universe.
And I know.
You don't want to let, you want to keep these people going, you know, put them in different situations and let them be themselves. It's a lot of fun.
I got a couple of books out there myself, and I'm publishing another one.
That's, good for you.
Yeah, this one's got all the interviews that I've done. I've done thousands of interviews, so I'm doing, you know, starting to put them out in series
one.
That's
a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, it's good for the kids to know about all the legends, you know, so.
Oh, yeah, totally. And,
yeah.
You know, now that I'm grandpa.
Right.
You know, I want to make sure that my legacy
exactly.
is handed down. You know, my son is going to carry on the family business
sure.
and my grandchildren, and, you know, hopefully they'll all be making records long after I'm gone. For records, jeez, you know, I can't even, I'm so old that, you know, I say records, they don't even make records anymore.
I know,
CDs or whatever, CDs are now gone.
They're gone too, yep.
Yeah, it's just everything. Well, what are you going to do? I tell you, songs like the breakup song,
yeah.
And Jeopardy really stand the test of time.
Oh, a great song.
And I do get, like, you know, my iTunes checks are always substantial.
Yep.
And one of the pure joys of life is owning my own songs and all the copyrights and everything.
Yep.
So when a dollar comes in, I don't have to split it with anybody.
Exactly.
And I tell you, man, I put two kids through college and I'm still going strong. You know, the mailbox money, for instance. You know, Weird Al did a version of Jeopardy.
Yep.
That was very famous. And his was number one. Mine was number one.
Yeah, amazing.
6 months later, his gets to number one.
Yeah.
I get half the money from his version.
Oh, really?
Half the royalties for that. Can you believe that?
Nothing wrong with it?
No, I'm still to this day. I still get mailbox money from Weird Al.
Wow.
God bless that man. So he puts I Lost on Jeopardy on Weird Al's Greatest Hits, which happens to go triple platinum. You know, and it's like somebody else had to hit, they went on the road.
That's cool.
And I still keep in contact with Weird Al.
Yeah,
in fact, I saw him in concert about 2 months ago.
Really?
And he was just, I'm telling you, man, I love that guy. He is just unbelievable. If you ever get a chance, you know, his audience is like, it's mostly kids.
Right.
You know, mostly like,
That's funny.
Yeah, he does something like that in every song. So, I mean, he's a wonderful guy. I love Weird Al. But, you know, there you go. The fact that he did Jeopardy means that it just lives forever.
Yeah, it does.
My ASCAP royalties just keep going in. And it's been, what, 30 years or something?
Greg, I got to ask you, how in the world did you come up with how did that happen?
Oh, hey, listen, man. The truth is, I didn't have enough lyrics. We had taken the verse from one song idea,
right,
and the chorus from another song idea, and put them together, and that was what the breakup song started out with as the track.
Uh-huh.
And I went in there and I had to do a rough vocal at the end of the day after we cut the track.
Right.
And I didn't have enough lyrics. So I knew I had a problem because I eventually was going to fill in all the, you know, we had broken up for good just an hour before.
Uh-huh.
And then something other than that. But then I got out there and I just... I mean, the thing came up, I didn't have anything to sing, so I just sang, And I thought that I was going to get a lecture from the band. I was going to go back into the control room, and those guys are going to go, all right, go home, write some lyrics, and come back tomorrow. You know, like, but, you know, I walk in there, they're all hugging me. I said, that's it, man, that's it.
That's awesome.
Those are the deepest lyrics you've ever
written.
That
is awesome.
And I made it up on the spot.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing.
And by the way, man, that translates into every language.
Yeah, it's true.
We play around the world. People come up to me in Belgium.
Yep.
Or Japan,
yep.
Tokyo, they go, oh, you're the guy, you're the uh-huh guy, I love you.
That's true, I never thought about that. That's great.
Yeah, you know, every once in a while, and of course, that was, all of that was unintended.
Yeah.
But that's really rock and roll. You know you're close to the source.
Yes, it is. It's so original.
When your mistakes become classics.
Yep, it's so original. It's so awesome.
I gotta hand it to myself. Looking back, I mean, I didn't tell anybody that I was completely unprepared. I just, they said, yo, that was the greatest lyrics you've ever written.
Yeah.
I knew that.
That's a great story. I like when you were talking too about, the ASCAP Awards, and Doc Severinsen played Jeopardy.
Oh, God, what a thrill.
Yeah, man.
You know, guys from my generation used to love Doc Severinsen.
Oh, yeah, me too.
You know, Tonight Show and Johnny Carson.
Sure.
And I'm at the ASCAP Awards,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, this was a trip. Who was the name of the guy that produced Michael Jackson, you know.
Quincy Jones?
Quincy Jones.
Right.
Quincy Jones. Quincy Jones is coming up to me,
mm-hmm,
and he's smiling, and he's extending his hand.
Right.
And I was standing directly in front of Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder right behind me, but he's lying, of course. He couldn't see the guy coming, right? I stand aside, for a nice corridor so he could go and hug Stevie Wonder. And he goes, no, I wanted to shake your hand. And he shakes my hand. He goes, I love Jeopardy, man. I just love that song.
Wow.
Can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
And then we heard it with the Doc Severinsen Tonight Show band. And that was, oh, man. Tell you, my head was huge that day.
You know you've arrived. When you hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's, yeah, when you have the Tonight Show band do your song, or you get parodied by Weird Al, you know. I mean, I know a lot of rock stars. In fact, my whole generation of guys, we all know each other.
Right.
And they're all, you know, I'm the only guy that got parodied by Weird Al. It was that, you know, I always got that over, you know, saying, you know, if I'm talking to Eddie Money, say, man, you know, come on. No parody, no you know, the nice thing about it has been that you were, I was really flattered. That means that you were well known enough to be parodied, which is, you know,
exactly.
Pretty cool.
Exactly, yeah. It's like if somebody does an impression of you, you know, if it's Rich Little doing an impression of you, you know, it's... That's
oh,
huge.
Man, wouldn't
yeah.
that be a trip?
Yeah.
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 You know, and I look back on my career, I've really been blessed. And
yep.
I really have been lucky. And, you know, if I had stayed in Baltimore and I never came out to the West Coast, God knows where I would.
Yeah, that was a big move. That was a good move.
Up in New York, I guess.
True.
True. You know, things just happen, and, you know, that's rock and roll, and that's, you know, you have to be karmically, you know, don't be an asshole, let everything, people, we just had a big reunion of the Keystone family. Freddie Herrera recently passed away. He was the owner of the Keystone.
Right.
So, you know, they had a big jam session, and the Earthquake was there.
Right.
And I played with my band, and Elvin Bishop was there, and Nick Gravenites, and all these people from the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed backstage, this guy doesn't talk to that guy. That guy doesn't talk to this guy.
That's a shame.
I was the only one I was talking to everybody.
Yeah, that's a
shame.
You
know, I had no, I had no baggage with any of these people.
That's
because,
important.
You know, it's karmic.
Yeah.
If you have a create, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? You live a karmically good life.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make enemies.
Right.
So now I show up at these things, everybody's hugging me, they're all saying, you know, we love you and all this stuff. And, you know, I know that this guy and that guy don't get along, and, you know, it's like Sinatra, he gets the Sicilian Alzheimer's.
Right.
The Sicilian Alzheimer's. You only remember the vendettas.
Right.
But, you know, I was all over the place, you know, and it was nothing but smiles and good vibes.
Yep.
And I remember, you know, I know other guys like that, you know, that they, you know, their lives have gone according to, you know, Lady Luck, you know. I remember meeting guys like Tom Petty when he made his first album. He was on Shelter Records, and he was in L.A. And I went over to the Shelter House. He was actually staying at the Shelter House at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing, you know, Denny Cordell play the demos for the first Tom Petty album. I thought to myself, Christ, this guy is great.
Yeah.
He's like another Bob Dylan. You know, he's definitely going to be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, here we are, what, 30, 40 years later. I hate to say it, you know, we've lost a lot of my good friends over the years, but
I know. You know,
that was one guy that fulfilled his promise, I think, in rock and roll. It's a good, you know, it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You do your gigs. You go out there. When I stop coming up with ideas, that's when I'll hang it up. You know, when I don't have a new song idea or a novel or something going, something that you want, then that'll be God's way of saying it, hang it up.
Yeah, but you are a true Renaissance man. You've got a lot of things going on, so you'll never get bored.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of what my friends say. I'm easily bored, and I keep, you know, changing projects.
Yeah.
You know, I at any one time I got at least two or three songs going.
Yep.
I got two going, say, this probably finishing up tomorrow. I got one novel in the can, and I'm 90% through the next novel. So
okay.
I'm really,
there you go.
These are the prime creative years, and you know, I say they came while the sun shines.
Yeah, you're still a young guy, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you know what? I'm looking at a lot of these people that I haven't seen in 20 or 30 years, and a lot of guys my age look like Wilford Brimley.
I know. I don't get it. I don't get it. Unless they're not taking care of themselves, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, well, apparently, everybody has got white hair now, and they're all like 40 pounds overweight. Right, so what are you going to do?
Yeah.
If I didn't play geeks all the time, I don't know what would happen to me. I think the geeks keep you young.
Right.
You're always working, you're always traveling, you're doing your job, and that's what keeps me young. I think if I stopped doing geeks, I'd start looking like Wilford Brimley.
I interviewed.
Yeah, coming up to me and he goes, "Hey man, you look the same." I feel the same. Basically, I don't look. I look around me and I see like everybody else. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's not in the cards, I guess.
I'm impressed. I interviewed John Mayall and I covered his show here in Sarasota. It was his 80th birthday. And the guy, he still tours, he sets up his own equipment, he's out there signing CDs for the fans, and somebody else that's still out there is Petula Clark, and she's like 90 years old,
Oh, it's amazing. I love Petula.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I remember getting for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
I had to tell my mother to get me an album that I wanted, the Blues Breakers Beano album.
Yep.
You know the Beano album?
Oh, yeah.
And it was with Clapton.
Yep.
And I got it for Christmas, man. Mm-hmm. It was my favorite album. I must have played it 1,000 times.
Guy still sounds great. He still sounds great,
Yeah, he's working solo, huh?
Yeah, well, he's got a 3-piece band, But he's a good guy, too. I was backstage with him. In his dressing room for his 80th birthday. I was expecting, like, Clapton to show up or somebody, for his 80th birthday.
Yeah.
Nobody showed up.
Hey, it's, maybe he's outlived his audience,
Probably.
Hey, I was playing, this is back in the 80s, we did a lot of state fairs.
Right.
And we were playing, I don't even know, somewhere in the middle of the country, Statefield.
Yep.
State fair, big place. And the night before, Bob Hope had played there.
Really?
Bob fucking Hope, one of my all-time idols.
Yeah.
And I asked the guy, the stage manager, what was it like for Bob? Because there was nobody here. And I said, how can that be?
Right.
Bob Hope is a huge star, and there's nobody here. He goes, he's outlived his audience.
Yeah, that's a shame.
The people that would come and see him, they're all in walkers now.
I know. I'm getting interviews with people you would never get interviews back in the day. Like, who I just interviewed recently? Connie Francis.
Wow.
I mean, back in the 50s, you couldn't even get near her.
No, but, I'll bet she's got some great stories
to tell. She does. She's awesome. She's awesome. Yeah, she lives in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale. But she's, she looks great. She talks great. She has fun. She's out with her friends, going for lunches and all kinds of different things. So many people don't even know who she is anymore, which is very sad.
Yeah. But there's a whole generation that has no idea.
Yep.
I make mixtapes to listen to in my car, right? Or driving to the studio.
Right.
So I'm always putting together playlists, just stuff and that. But I always put, Connie Francis.
Yep.
Patsy Cline,
mm-hmm.
Hank Williams,
right.
Ray Charles, sure. Whatever pops into my head,
exactly.
I hear it.
Yeah, I do the same.
And, I play it for my daughter, not my grandkids, but my daughter. They said, gee, that's a great song. Who is that? Honey, that's Kitty Wells. Who's Kitty Wells? Oh, you have to be there, I guess.
That's something. Yeah, that's the thing that bothers me, though, because I interview all these people, and all the younger generation, even up to 40 years old, they don't even know who I'm interviewing anymore. It's kind of it makes me mad.
History is not their strong suit.
Yeah, it makes me mad.
Yeah, a lot of these people don't even know what happened in World War II.
Exactly.
I mean, you think they want to drop the voting age to, what, 16 now?
Oh, do they? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, 18 to 16, and I'm thinking, Jesus, when I was 16, I could barely tie my own shoes. I mean, I was just a goofy guy.
Yeah, me
I had
too.
No idea. I was just,
yeah.
You know what I mean? We were so sexually repressed that if a girl came up and said hello to us, we'd break out in pimples.
True. Greg, where'd you go to high school?
Poly.
Okay.
I went to Baltimore Polytechnic Institute on North Avenue.
Wow.
And I was the last graduating class from the old school.
Wow.
Before they went out to Roland Lane or whatever that is.
Yeah.
But yes, Poly, man. Poly City Gate. I grew up 3 blocks from Memorial Stadium.
Really?
Right there on Southway.
Yep.
And it was unbelievable. I mean, we used to park cars for the Colts games.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Me and my buddies would go up there, we'd park them, and we'd make a couple of bucks, and then they let you go in after the second quarter started. So I used to see all the Colts games and all the Orioles games by the third inning on.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, those were great times. And
yeah.
You know, I will never forgive Robert Ersey for moving the Colts out of Baltimore.
You know, there's rumors about the Orioles now. Did you hear that? About moving them to Nashville. Can you believe that crap?
Oh, my God. That's just horrible.
It is horrible. I mean, you know, ever since what's his name, Angelos and his family took over the Orioles, it's been downhill, man.
Oh, jeez.
It's unreal.
Yeah, of course, the Orioles are the class of the American League for years.
Yep. Yeah, and we just lost Frank Robinson. That hurt. You know. Those are my heroes.
And Gino Marchetti.
Gino Marchetti, yeah, that's right.
Gino fucking Marchetti.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? Gino was, when I was a kid, when I was 13, I had a folk group with my cousin.
Uh-huh.
Okay? We were called the Voyagers, and we did, like, Kingston Trio songs.
This
was even before the Beatles. And my uncle used to work for the Baltimore Colts, taking the game film.
Mm-hmm.
They had a thing called the Racing Film Patrol, and they filmed Pimlico, so all the races at Pimlico.
Yep.
So when the Colts moved to town, they had looked around for somebody to film the game films, they called my uncle in,
right.
And you know, he became the guy that, you know, for 20 years. So I used to go down to Westminster where they were doing their spring training, their preseason,
right?
And they had a thing called Rookie Night where all the rookies had to get up and sing a song or make a skit. And they were hilarious. Somebody got drunk. I guess they don't do that in the NFL anymore. Everybody got plastered. And I remember going up there and playing stuff like Tom Dooley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the songs like that in front of the Colts.
Yeah.
And they were just as drunk as could be. I remember the only guy that was not drunk was Raymond Berry and Johnny Unitas. Johnny Unitas was not drinking either.
Huh.
But everybody else was just ripped. And I remember, I think, you know, we lived right by the stadium. So two or three of the Colts, like Carl Tassif, went to our church.
Mm-hmm.
So every Sunday morning before the Colts came, he'd be at church and you could see him right there three rows ahead of you.
Yeah. That's
cool. And they knew a part of the community. Johnny Unitas Bowling Alley.
That's right.
Like 3 blocks from my house.
That's right. Johnny Unitas Fair Lanes, I think it was called, or something like that.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, Gino's. Remember Gino's?
Gino's. That was a great place to eat.
Amici's.
Don Amici,
At Amici's when we were in high school.
Yeah.
Maybe one guy could get a car.
Right.
And we would drive out, hang there, and try to pick up chicks. And we were like 16 or 17. And it was the Amici's drive-in. I think it was on Rock Raven.
Right. I think so.
I remember the song. I'll meet you at Amici's. Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah. You remember the Double T Diner? That's still there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A good friend of mine, Alan Mason, in L.A., was the guy that the Colts fanatic in Diner.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he couldn't marry the chick until she passed the Colts quiz.
Right.
Yeah. That guy, the real guy, is a friend of mine named Alan Mason.
Huh.
A lot of that stuff really did happen.
Wow.
But, it was the Colts were part of the community.
Yes, they were.
They really were. That's why it ripped the heart out.
I know.
When Thursday was like, he got a better deal down the road.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you know what? There's always going to be a better deal down the road.
I know.
It's always going to be like that. You know, what's the great thing about the Green Bay Packers?
Right.
They stay, and they're owned by the city of Green Bay.
Exactly. Yep. The whole city goes to the game.
Every team should be like that.
Yeah. You know what I did? In 1990, I did a fantasy camp with the Orioles.
I've always wanted to do one of those.
And Brooksy was there, Earl Weaver, Paul Blair.
Oh, man.
I had a blast. And the year after, Joan Jett did it. Because Joan used to live in, I think, Rockville or Silver Spring or something like that.
Yep, that's right.
Yep.
That's right. My mom and her mom were friends.
Really?
I hear the funny thing because my mother, is just a great Baltimore mother.
Yep, my mom
too. She didn't have any kind of valves on her which she just said what she thought.
Yep.
And I remember her we were playing in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
God, I remember like it was yesterday. Oh, Joan Jett was the opener. And it was around the Jeopardy time.
Right.
And Joan Jett comes off stage and she's all sweaty.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother walks up to her. And I'm thinking, oh God, what is she going to say? And she goes, honey, you're such a pretty girl. Why don't you smile? Smile, and the world smiles with you. And I kind of came up behind her. Mom, Joan Jett is not smiling. She's not going to smile. That's not her thing.
That's funny.
And she's going, no, honey, you're so pretty.
That's a good story.
Smile. She's looking at my mom like my mom's nuts. And I go, what can I say?
Yeah.
Later on, she says that she got a kick out of that when she was telling Kenny Laguna,
uh-huh.
You think I should smile? Fuck no, man.
That's funny.
That's not hilarious. That's not your your image. Your image is tough.
I covered Joan in Tampa at Busch Gardens, and the only time I've ever seen her smile, she likes girls. And in the audience, there was two girls, getting her attention and hanging all over each other. That's when she smiled.
Oh, there you go.
That's when she smiled. Yeah. But she's pretty cool. Greg, here's...
I love her. She's real people.
She is.
I really love her. I've known her and Kenny Laguna.
Yep.
Kenny Laguna, produced a couple of my early albums.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Before he was Joan Jett's manager, when Joan was still in the Runaways.
Right. Yeah, I know.
Here's another thing, too.
Yeah.
Kenny Laguna was one of the original Tommy James and the Shondells.
That's right.
He was an original Shondell.
That everybody knows that.
And he goes out to, plays keyboard.
Yeah.
And he, and of course, the Shondells were on Roulette Records.
Right.
Which was the Mob.
Yep.
Morris Levy. And he used to, we'd be on the road, and he'd tell you the time when Morris Levy hung a guy out the window by his ankles? No, let's hear that story. You know, the unbelievable stories.
I can't
even repeat them now, but they were just fabulous.
Yeah, he's got a whole book on that. You know, me, the mob, and
That was kind of what it was like. You know,
it was. Yeah, it was like that. Here's a question. Well, here's a question I ask everybody. This is your wrap up question here. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, man. I'd say Lennon and McCartney.
Lennon and McCartney,
yep. Yeah, in the early days, when they were writing their first, I Want to Hold Your Hand stuff. Yeah, I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall for that one. But then again, I could say also Bob Dylan, because I remember Bob Dylan was a humongous influence for not only me, but all the people I knew.
Yeah.
I remember buying the Freewheeling Bob Dylan. It was his second album, and I must have played it 1,000 times, and I knew every song and every note. I could play the entire album. And I just, it blew my mind. And then it was also, Keith Richards. I mean, I love Keith.
Mm-hmm.
I got to meet him a couple of times when we opened for the Stones. And that was really a thrill.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah. And, the way that Keith Richards' heart is oldies.
Oldies, really?
You know what I mean? Huh. He starts doing a song.
Mm-hmm.
He'll pick up a guitar and he'll start singing like a song that you sort of know, the theme from Rawhide or something.
Right.
And if you can jump in there and sing the second verse, I mean, that's it. They respect you.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Jerry Garcia.
Right.
Jerry Garcia was backstage at the Keystone, and I was there, and he always liked me, and we were smoking joints and stuff.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Hey, you know Rocky Top? We want to do Rocky Top."
Right.
And I said, "Yeah, I know the whole thing. Osborne Brothers, right? Yeah. Okay, yeah, I could do that." He goes, "Well, could you come up and sing it with us? Because I don't know the lyrics.
Hmm.
I said, "Yeah, man." In the middle of the set, I go up there, and I remember remembering the verses, thinking to myself, "Like, it's a miracle that I know this shit."
Yeah.
Who else knows the words from Rocky Top? But I knew it all. You know, once two strangers came on Rocky Top looking for a moonshine pill.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, those two ain't been down to Rocky Top. Guess they never will.
Yeah. Amazing.
I remember commercials from when I used to listen to them on the radio when I was like 16.
Yeah.
You know, we were in high school. Stuff here really stuck.
Yeah.
I remember, all the commercials. I mean, those Fat Daddy commercials were unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do this place called Manchester.
Right.
Manchester Clothes. And it was in downtown Baltimore. I guess it must have been a black place. I never been to it, but he started doing these go, "Manchester, Manchester, Manchester, sale, 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 Manchester, Manchester." And then he'd do all these riffs like, "It feels so good, it feels so nice. You back up and walk in twice."
Yeah, love that. I love it.
Yeah.
I love
scream
it.
And holler like when you spend your power.
I love it. That good old days of radio, man.
Oh, man. Yeah, they don't have that kind of personality radio
anymore.
No,
they don't. No, they don't. You know what I do now, besides this radio show I have? I work for a company called Circuitalia. It's kind of like Circus de Soleil, and I handle the paranormal Cirque, which is a very dark adult-only circus that travels all over the country. I buy all the radio ads, so I'm negotiating.
Really? Yeah.
I'm negotiating with all the radio stations around the country to buy advertising. So I'm on the other side.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, It's right,
well, God bless you, man. I tell you, you're fully immersed now.
I am. But I was a top 40 guy back in the late 70s, too. And
Yeah. Well, we all were back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah.
But I loved being on K-Fox for 17 years.
That's awesome.
It was classic rock. So,
you must have had a blast.
I was playing, you know, Led Zeppelin and Clapton and stuff like that.
Weren't you talking about an internet deal that you were going to work on? Some kind of,
Yeah, you know, the problem was, it's so much work. I signed up to do a bunch of gigs with Rick this summer.
Right.
I was just going to kind of take it easy and cherry pick the gigs I wanted to play.
Right.
You know, I don't need to, you know, I don't have to beat myself up to make money or anything, so, you know, I just do what I want to do.
Right.
And the more I got into it, like, you know, I didn't know if I wanted to make that commitment every day.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
And where am I going to give back that time? It's going to be from my novel writing or songwriting or something else. You got to pull that time.
True.
I've done that, you know.
Yeah.
I've done that. I know that, you know, once you get rolling, that's it. That's your life.
That's right.
Every day, that's what you think about.
That's
What's
right.
the show going to be out?
Exactly.
What am I doing today?
Yeah. I've had to come up with, I really rarely have a rerun on my show, and I've been doing these interviews now for about almost 4 years. I've always had a new guest every week. So that's hard to do.
Yeah.
You know?
But, you know, that does keep it fresh. You have to fresh, you're going to die.
Exactly. But I'll put you in the I don't know, series 2 or 3 in my series of books of interviews. I'll let you know when I get that far, and so I can get permission from you.
Beautiful. Hey, Ray, thanks for everything. That was a great interview.
Hey, man, I feel like I'm talking to family.
Yeah, well, kind of you are.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, man.
All Baltimore boys are family.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. Do you know Niels Lofgren by any chance?
Yeah, sure, I know Niels.
Yeah, he's a good guy from Baltimore.
Well, I knew him when he was in Grin.
In Grin, yeah.
And Grin used to play in Baltimore.
That's right.
The Blues at a Go-Go.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, places like House and State.
Right.
Like that.
Right.
And I always used to go see Grin. I loved him.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first guy I ever saw use a Guild Roto sound. Was like the first, it made this whirling, it was like I can't describe it, it was this weird sound. He was the first guy to get it. Right after the Fuzz Tone came out, the Guild Roto sound, and it had this really cool, like, it sounded like a Leslie tone cabinet.
Right.
So, anyway, hey, listen, I love talking to you.
Me too,
I've enjoyed this. Let's do it again sometime, Ray.
Sure will. Thank you, man. Thank you for all the great music. And come to Florida, man, when you get a chance.
I you know what? I'm planning on it. So keep your eye out.
I will. Thanks again, man, for being on the show.
All righty. Take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye. Purchase the latest release by the Greg Kidd Band entitled Rekindled at Amazon.com. It is a great album. 5 stars all the way. For more information about Greg Kinn, visit www.gregkinn.com or www.facebook.com/Greg Kinn. You can also purchase Greg's novels, Rubber Soul, a novel by Greg Kinn, Painted Black, Dustbin Bob Book 2, Horror Show, Big Rock Beat, A Wacky Zany Romp, and also Mojo Hand, Special Warfare Book Number 4. And Wacky Zany Romp is Special Warfare Book Number 3. You can buy all of Greg Kinn's books at Greg Kinn's website, or you can go to Amazon.com. They're all available there. Very special thanks to John Lappin for arranging this interview with Greg Kinn, and of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com, and please subscribe to my YouTube channel, interviewing the legends with Ray Shasho for the very latest interviews. It's real news. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on PBS Radio, Station 1.